You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next 60 minutes, following Israel's approval of 3,000 new homes in the occupied territory, we assess how far off the rails the Middle East peace process has now been pushed.
We hope that France and Britain can begin to show Israel that it cannot continue business as usual. Israel settlement activities cannot continue being business as usual. Every possible effort must be exerted in order to preserve the two-state solution.
Also ahead, Qatar's efforts to be seen as a forum for free debate are called into question as a prominent poet is jailed for insulting the emir.
This story really exposes the hypocrisy of Qatar. Qatar has had this external policy over the last year and a half, very much trying to support the Arab Spring, especially through its Al Jazeera television network. But of course, dissent in its own backyard is not being tolerated.
And France's former First Lady says we don't need feminists anymore. We ask, why should the country's most famous stay-at-home mum ever feel the need to express herself thus?
She said many things. She said her words had been taken out of context. And she also said that it was a clumsy phrase. But she said that if feminism means wanting more freedom, then she is a feminist. And I love the if.
Plus, we'll take lunch in New York and we'll play you some great music too. So lots to come in the next hour here on Midori House. First, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines from James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. It's just been announced that the United Nations is to pull out all non-essential international staff from Syria as the situation around the capital Damascus becomes more and more dangerous. As many as 25 out of 100 international staff could leave this week, according to the UN's own news agency. All field trips outside the capital have been halted temporarily as officials fear staff will be at increased risk from indiscriminate shooting. Israel has rejected concerted criticism from across Europe over Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to expand settlement building after the United Nations' de facto recognition of Palestinian statehood. Britain, France, Spain, Sweden and Denmark summoned the Israeli ambassadors in their capitals to hear appeals for Mr. Netanyahu to reverse course and deep disapproval of the plan to erect 3,000 more homes in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. The authorities in Japan have ordered emergency inspections of road tunnels across the country following the collapse of a tunnel near Tokyo in which 9 people were killed. An inquiry has begun into Sunday's collapse of the Sasago Tunnel around 50 miles west of Tokyo. 2 Kenyan presidential hopefuls indicted by the International Criminal Court for allegedly inciting post-election violence have signed a pact to join forces in next year's vote by running on the same ticket. Deputy Prime Minister Uhuru Kenyatta and former Cabinet Minister William Ruto announced the deal at a rally hosted by Ruto's United Republican Party and Kenyatta's the National Alliance Party in the Rift Valley town of Nakuru, 140 kilometres northwest of the capital Nairobi. Political analyst Tom Maliti has warned that Kenya would lose the respect of much of the world if it allowed wanted criminal suspects to run for senior office.
If the court issues arrest warrants against the 2 individuals, that will have huge implications for the country because it will be a signal to now the rest of the world that the leadership of Kenya are wanted suspects, criminals, accused people. And therefore, there will be questions asked in different capitals on the continent in Africa, and also in the world about whether those countries can do business with Kenya.
The Doha climate negotiations have entered their second week. Correspondents say the extra time will determine whether the negotiations will gain positive result, as there was no substantial progress in the first week. On the core issue of emission cuts, the EU proposed the goal of 20%. However, developing countries cannot accept the figure. Canada and Japan have declared they will not participate in the second commitment period, while the United States has been out of the Kyoto Protocol. China's top climate change negotiator, Xi Zhenhua, expressed China's stand on the negotiations, stating that the developed countries were responsible historically for climate change. And top UN climate official Cristiana Figueres confirmed China's effort to emission reduction.
A century from now, which country will historians see as the pioneer of clean energy technology into a future of supercharged growth and health and wealth and stability for its citizens? We don't know how that question will be answered. It could be one country, it could be several, but for sure, it will include China.
The Philippine President Benigno Aquino has told people to take storm warnings seriously as authorities evacuated thousands of residents of coastal and mountain regions hours before the biggest typhoon this year was due to hit. Typhoon Bofa, with winds of 108 miles an hour and gusts of up to 130, is expected to make landfall early on Tuesday on the southern island of Mindanao. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. James will be back in a little under half an hour to bring us a full roundup of the world news headlines. You with Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres,
Holanda,
London,
Europe,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
The international condemnation of Israel's announcement that it plans to build 3,000 new homes in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem have come thick and fast. The United Kingdom, France, Denmark, Spain and Sweden have all summoned their ambassadors, and the Russians have voiced their concern too. It was announced that a barren scrap of land known as E1 would be the site of fresh Israeli construction. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said they will continue to build all the places that are on the map of Israel's strategic interests. But in so doing, is he scuppering any prospect of a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians? Daniel Seidemann of the NGO Terrestrial Jerusalem worries that this will be the case.
E1 is not just another settlement. E1 will dismember the West Bank into a northern canton and a southern canton, and E1 will seal East Jerusalem from its environs in the West Bank. In the absence of the possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state with a connection to Jerusalem, there is no two-state solution.
That was Daniel Seidemann from the NGO Terrestrial Jerusalem there. Now, in a moment, we'll assess the long-term effects of today's announcement when we'll be joined in the studio by Daniela Pellad, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. But first, let's head to the Middle East, where Joseph Dana can join us on the line from Ramallah. Welcome to Midori House, Joseph. Just tell us what the reaction's been there where you are.
Well, the reaction's been very surprised. I think it's really kind of mirroring the reaction from the international community. Many people thought that Israel would take some sort of reaction to this very bold United Nations statehood bid on the part of the Palestinians. But I think that the real image was that Israel would take kind of rhetorical steps, saying that this is a move that is bad for peace, that the party should go back to the negotiations table. But these practical steps that Israel has taken in announcing settlement creation in the West Bank, as well as seizing Palestinian tax revenue that it's been holding, has really taken a lot of people by surprise on the ground and in the international community, as you correctly noted in the introduction.
Just tell us a little bit more about E1 and what would happen if it were built on.
Well, with all of this discussion about E1, you would think it's this kind of grand place, but it's actually just a barren kind of wasteland between Jerusalem and the West Bank. There's a major Israeli settlement called Male Adumim, which is it's almost a city, really. And between Male Adumim and Jerusalem is this barren corridor that I'm talking about. Now, the Palestinians are worried that if Israel was to build Jewish settlements inside of this corridor, it would basically cut the West Bank, what they want to be their state, in half, in north and south kind of quadrants. It would also kind of encircle Jerusalem with a line of Israeli settlements, which would make having East Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital basically impossible. And so this is why this kind of barren wasteland has become such a kind of game changer on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
We have a ceasefire in place currently between Israel and Hamas. How secure is that now?
Well, Israel, thankfully, you know, kind of the situation in Gaza has gone away from the headlines. There hasn't been that much kind of outright violence between the two sides. Hamas haven't fired any rockets, last time I checked. There's been a couple of, you know, skirmishes around the border zone with Israeli, you know, troops and kind of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But that looks like it's holding. You know, Egypt has got its own problems, but they are the guarantor of that kind of shaky ceasefire. But it looks in place. And so these settlement moves on the West Bank don't seem to be kind of impacting that fragile ceasefire at the moment.
Joseph, stay with us on the line. We're joined now by Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Daniela, welcome. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. The commentators have been warning that this is the end of a two-state solution if E1 is built on. What are your thoughts on that?
I think a large number of commentators would say that the ship of the two-state solution has sailed a long time ago. I mean, it's still the only plan on the table, but peace negotiations are, to say that they were moribund would be an understatement. There's no meaningful progress. There hasn't been any meaningful progress. There's no apparent partner for any meaningful progress on either side.
And it appears that this scrap of land, E1, is what has brought all the difficulties to the fore again. Just hearing Daniel Seidemann saying that they would be dismembering the West Bank, this would have a devastating effect on any kind of peace process, wouldn't it?
And the E1 building has been a red line for Israel's partners in Europe, which is why they've taken this step of threatening to withdraw their ambassadors. The issue about the settlements in the West Bank is that many of them, under a number of peace plans, would be able to be incorporated into an Israeli state with some land swaps and so on. But the Palestinians see Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, as their capital. And anything that disconnects the West Bank from what is its cultural and social and economic hub would be disastrous for any future Palestinian state.
Can you see E1 being built on?
Well, that's another issue, because it's been used as a political football for nearly 20 years. There are forever threats to build there, and it's a long process. You know, when they have to be planning it, then they have to put tenders up for approval, and we haven't got to that stage yet. But it's a sign of how potent a threat it is that it's had this reaction.
Have we been here before in terms of Israel saying, okay, we're going to go and do something, and the entire international community just suddenly going up in arms against it?
I think this is a very interesting development. I mean, coming as it does after the Gaza conflict, and Israel had a remarkable amount of support from some of its partners. William Hague was behind the Israeli military adventure, largely, had backing from various quarters. And I think there's a feeling that Israel really needs to give a little bit back to its friends in the international community. And this is nothing more than a sort of petulant reaction to what the Palestinians have legitimately put forward as a peaceful, non-violent, legal attempt to gain statehood.
Joseph, what's your response to that? The idea that Netanyahu's statement is a knee-jerk reaction to the UN General Assembly vote, which overwhelmingly upgraded the Palestinians' diplomatic status that was done last week?
Well, I was in Jerusalem this afternoon, and I was speaking with a number of Israelis on the street about, you know, reaction to this E1 settlement announcement. And a lot of people here are very scared that Netanyahu is, again, kind of overplaying his hand with the American president, Obama. They believe that, as I noted earlier, that, you know, there were going to be some necessary rhetorical steps on the Israeli side, saying this is a counterproductive move in the United Nations, the only path to peace is through negotiations of both parties. But this very bold kind of threat of crossing this red line of building an E1 is still sending, you know, kind of shivers down a lot of Israelis' backs. They believe that there's going to be a certain time, there's going to be a certain threshold that the Americans simply can't put up with. I mean, the Europeans, it's kind of expected. You know, there's been a lot more kind of kickback from Europe on the settlement issue. But again, the Americans remain the real kind of sacred cow in the whole situation. If they are going to change their tone on this situation on the West Bank, I think Israelis are going to be very, very angry with their leadership. And so we're going to have to see how this unfolds.
But at the same time, I think that we have to view this in the context of what's going on in internal Israeli politics. So their elections are due in January, and Israeli politics is taking a very dramatic turn to the right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had the Likud primaries, which have returned a list. I mean, the Likud is a right-wing party, but there were some centrist elements in it. The centrist pragmatists seem to have completely disappeared from the Likud slate. And even further to the right of Yisrael Beiteinu, which is Avigdor Lieberman's party, there are parties which are taking a further extreme view, and the threat of settlement building could be seen as a way to grandstanding to attract some internal votes, which is very strange, because I think that on both sides there is a majority that still believe in a two-state solution, that feel that progress is there to be made in the centre. But there's a constituency in search of a political party at the moment in Israel.
Joseph just mentioned there that he thinks that Netanyahu might be overplaying his hand in terms of how much support the United States will give him. Would you agree with that?
Well, Netanyahu has historically never got on well with American presidents, and certainly his relationship with Obama has been fraught. As the cliche goes, an American president in his second term looks towards the Middle East. I think there are many people who'd be very happy if Obama took a more strenuous line with Netanyahu and a more decisive line. But he hasn't lived up to many of the expectations people had of the achievements he might make in the Middle East. So I'm not too sure about that. The Netanyahu government has been very stable. It's lasted the full four-year term, which is very rare in Israeli politics.
Daniela Pellet from the Institute of War and Peace reporting, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. And Joseph Dana from Ramallah, my thanks as well. The time is 16 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. In a moment, we head to Shanghai to hear of China's plans for Central Asia.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Eighteen minutes past the hour, you're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, where lies the economic future of Central Asia? It's an area that's seen investment from India and Japan, but little attention paid to it from the likes of Europe. Now a summit is being held in Kyrgyzstan, and it's throwing the region into sharp international focus. It appears that the major player to watch out for is China, of course, a country eager to improve links between its poorest province, Xinjiang, and Central Asia. Monocle's Anna John caught up with Raffaello Pantani. He's a visiting scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Science, and Raffaello explained what China's great game could well be.
The fundamental rationale behind China's interest and push in Central Asia is based around trying to develop its westernmost province, Xinjiang, which accounts for about a sixth of the country's landmass, but is a vast empty space, only has about less than 1% of the entire population of the country. Around 20 million people over a space that's, you know, almost the size of Western Europe. This area has always been historically very poor. It's been very underdeveloped, and it's beset with ethnic tensions. And the Chinese government thinks that the solution to a lot of these problems is economic development. And to do this economic development, it thinks that it needs to therefore develop the region around Xinjiang and to develop Xinjiang's links to the region around it, which would be Central Asia. So the underlying rationale behind China's interest there is to try to develop its western province. In parallel to this, they're also very interested in Central Asia's rich natural resources. As I'm sure everyone knows, this is an area of the world where there is an awful lot of gas, oil, and other minerals. So China's very interested in securing those as well.
How does China's presence in the region play in comparison to that of Japan and indeed India?
Well, Japan and India are both powers, Asian powers, that have expressed an interest in Central Asia, and they've done this through investment. India recently has had quite a big push trying to get to Central Asian energy fields, while Japan recently gave a large loan of some $700 million in aid to the region, and this was to try to strengthen its economic links to the region. However, the big difference is that while these countries sort of invest these large amounts, they're very strategically focused on specific things, the Chinese are really rebuilding roads, rail links, and pipelines that lead all back to China. And they're really sort of changing the face of the entire region.
And in the past week, we've had the visit of Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign minister. She's come to Central Asia. Does that signify to you that there is a real interest from Europe? I mean, obviously, there's an interest from Europe in China and the Central Asia region, but how does, say, the European interest in the region compare, again, to that of Japan and India, but most importantly, to China?
Well, in many ways, the European approach, I mean, back in 2007, the Europeans launched a new strategy for Central Asia. It was a white paper, and it was launched with great fanfare, and the idea was that the Europeans are going to refocus their entire strategy on this part of the world to try to really engage with it and try to develop it as a key sort of connection for the European Union. Unfortunately, since that strategy was launched 5 years ago, very little tangible progress has happened on the ground. In contrast, the Chinese have built pipelines from a number of key energy fields in the region. They've built a road network that extends increasingly across Kyrgyzstan, increasingly into Tajikistan, even up to Uzbekistan and into parts of Kazakhstan. While the Europeans have sort of done a little bit of investment in very strategic and very specific things. This also contrasts to the Japanese and the Indians, who have very focused on economic interests. So in a way, the Europeans, what they've done instead is they've tended to focus more on trying to do aid projects or trying to help with regional cooperation, which is sort of very good diplomatic work to do, but it doesn't really get to the nitty-gritty of investing in economies, which is ultimately what these countries are looking for.
Is there a sense that Catherine Ashton's visit is, let's say, wanting in terms of, it's lacking some of the direction that might be needed in terms of Europe's trade opportunities with China?
Catherine Ashton's visit, I think, is symbolic because she visited most of the countries of the region. She visited all of them except for Turkmenistan. It was her first visit to Kyrgyzstan. They hosted a large summit of Central Asian ministers out there, and it had a certain high profile. So it does signify that the Europeans still are very interested in the region. However, I think if you're going to look at sort of tangible progress on the ground, I'm afraid to say that the European Union is unfortunately lagging behind. China, certainly, and even to some degree, countries like Japan or Korea or even India.
How much scope is there then for Europe to play a trade role through transport networks invested in by China through Central Asia then?
Well, this is a big thing which I think should be looked out in the future. At the end of the day, when China is investing in developing its networks into the region, they're ultimately investing not only in developing their links to the region as a market, but investing in links through the region. And if we look at a map, you would think that from China through Central Asia, you go to Russia and then ultimately to Europe. And so that's ultimately where these road links are trying to lead. So this ultimately does sort of recreate a part of the Silk Road directly connecting China to Europe. Where the Europeans are in a position to refocus their interest is that this is a part of the world where they are very much seen as power that lots of these countries would like to have closer relationships with. At the end of the day, these Central Asians see themselves or would like to aspire to be European powers with the same sort of values, with the same sort of lifestyle that you'd have in Western Europe. So for them, Europe is a power that they would like to engage with. So they appreciate it when Europe does get engaged. The problem is that if we look at the sort of experience on the ground, we can see that other powers that are closer have actually done a lot more in a much shorter period. But ultimately, these countries aspire to be more like Western Europe than like China.
This week has seen the Shanghai Cooperation Organization hold a Prime Minister's Summit in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. What can we draw from that meeting? Without asking you to look into the looking glass, what do you see to be the tangible results from that increased connection between Central Asia and Europe in the near future?
Well, Well, I'm ultimately quite optimistic about this connection between Central Asia and Europe. I think Central Asia is a part of the world which is underdeveloped and overlooked often, where it has a lot of potential. There's a lot of rich and natural resources in the region, and once they resolve some of the governance issues that they have there, there's a lot of potential for it to become a relatively affluent corner of the world. However, if we look at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a slightly parallel entity within this, I mean, if we talk about the summit that they're doing this week, I have a feeling that the SCO is an entity which is going to play a role in the future of Central Asia, but maybe not the defining role that China, the power that ultimately created it, would like it to be. The SCO is a regional organization that has developed in the past 11 years into being something of some standing, but it has yet to really produce much evidence that it is doing anything beyond being much more than a talking shop. This summit in Bishkek is interesting because it's a big prime ministerial meeting, and it's the first one after their big 10-year anniversary. And the Pakistanis in particular are going to be there and are going to push to become full members of the organization. But the reality is that they're unlikely to come to a decision on that in the same way that they're unlikely to come to a decision on a lot of things. So I think that, you know, going forward, the SCO is going to be an important regional player. But I think the European Union, if it's able to really refocus itself on engaging with Central Asia, and I think engaging with China in Central Asia, it could really become an important regional actor.
That was Raffaello Pantucci, the visiting scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, talking to Monocle's Aled John there. You're with Midori House. In a moment, we head to Japan. It's just gone 26 minutes past the hour here at Midori House in London. Now, in March of last year, Japan was dealt a triple disaster that left vast swathes of the country with almost unimaginable destruction. First, there was a magnitude earthquake of 9, then a massive tsunami, and a subsequent nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. The Tokyo-based journalist and academic David McNeil is one of the co-authors of a new book called Strong in the Rain. It follows the narratives of six individuals caught up in these tragedies, from the mayor of a coastal town to a factory worker who volunteered to return to Fukushima to fight the unfolding disaster. In London for the time being, he joined our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield in the studio earlier today.
Now, you've been based in Tokyo for a long time. You wrote this book with Lucy Birmingham, who writes for Time, who's also been in Tokyo for a long time. Before we talk about the characters in the book itself, what was this disaster like for you to cover initially?
Well, as we say in the prologue, we're both based in Japan for many years. Lucy's been there for nearly 20 and has three children to a Japanese man. And I'm married to a Japanese woman. And she was pregnant, actually, when the earthquake struck. So there was a sort of personal drama for both of us, if you like. You know, for Lucy, it was wondering if her kids were safe. One of them in particular went off the radar for hours and eventually turned up in a refugee center, a school. And in my particular case, we were in one of the busiest train stations in Tokyo, a place called Shinagawa. And at the point of the earthquake, we were under one of the oldest sections of it. So there was that sort of initial fear of literally, are you going to survive? You know, I remember thinking we may not survive this. You know, this roof may come down on top of us. And then afterwards, once that sort of initial terror was gone, there was the job of just covering it, you know, and trying to covering the disaster, of course, and then trying to balance that with your personal life. So in my particular case, Lucy, I can't talk for, but in my case, because Nanika was pregnant and, you know, obviously feeling as insecure as you can imagine in that situation, I had to sort of do my job, which involved going up to the Northwest when we didn't really know a lot about the nuclear disaster. At one point, we thought it was much worse than it was. So going towards the disaster rather than away from it, like most people were leaving, you know, leaving for the West or leaving Japan altogether, while at the same time trying to sort of look after her, if you like, and make sure she was okay. So there was that kind of that constant tension, if you like, between your personal life and your professional life.
Let's talk about some of the characters in the book. I mean, how did you decide, and why did you decide to focus on six individuals?
Well, we, during the course of covering the disaster, of course, we came across these people all the time. And they had these remarkable stories, and they were remarkable people. And the Tohoku region of the northeast region of Japan is sort of famous for its stoic character, if you like. You know, the people, they just didn't want to really talk about what happened to them, and they didn't want to be seen to be grandstanding. And that, in a way, made it sort of more compelling. You know, these people, they had to be sort of persuaded, if you like, to tell their stories. So we came across, obviously, a lot of these people. And when we had time to sort of catch our breath, we said, well, you know, rather than just using a line or two or a quote or two from these people, as which is all you can do in a newspaper article or magazine article, why don't we try and tell their stories in more detail, you know, and tell the disaster through their eyes. And then what once we made that decision, what we had to do was kind of narrow down the people that we had. So initially we had about 15, and we ended up with these six because we thought, well, A, they were very compelling stories, but also I think there was some way indicative of sort of sections of life in Japan, if you like. You know, one's a fisherman. You have to have a fisherman in Japan, right? Mm. In a country synonymous with the sea. One is a nuclear power plant worker. Obviously, you have to have someone like that.
Well, let's talk about a nuclear power plant worker, because that person actually went back to Fukushima, to the factory itself.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that story.
Well, he grew up in a place called Okuma, which is, it's actually officially the host to the nuclear power plant. It's the host town. And, you know, there were lots of reasons why his story was so interesting. One was because he wasn't at all opposed to nuclear power. Most of the people, of course, in Okuma, because they had received, not only, but one of the reasons was because they had received such huge subsidies. You know, the town was built largely on the sort of largesse from this nuclear power plant. So, of course, his grandfather worked in the power plant, and a lot of his relatives. So there was absolutely no sense of danger at all about working there. So the story is partly about sort of his crashing illusions, if you like. You know, he was in the power plant when all of this happened, of course, and thought he was going to die. And then sort of even more remarkable to me was his sense of duty once the disaster kicked off. You know, he was in a place called Iwaki, which is safely out of the way of the power plant, and he was just waiting for the call to go back when it came, you know, to go back and fight the disaster. And when it did, he sort of went back. That was it, you know. And he was there for the following year, and was exposed to so much radiation that he feared for his own health. You know, he in his interviews with us, I mean, I'm not qualified to judge the impact of the radiation on his body, but I know what he said, and that was that he worried if he would be able to have children, and he felt that he would not be able to have a relationship with a woman because he would have to confess, you know, this is my job, this is what's happened to me. So he was basically condemning himself to a single life.
And that was David McNeil there, journalist and author of a new book called Strong in the Rain, talking to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield a little earlier on today. Stay with us here on Midori House, because in the next half hour of the programme, I'll remember which programme I'm presenting, and we'll also check in with our New York Bureau Chief for the latest news stateside. We'll talk about Carla Bruni's views on feminism, and we'll hear how the historic Arab tradition of duelling poets has fallen victim to Qatar's laws on free speech.
This story really exposes the hypocrisy of Qatar. Qatar has had this external policy over the last year and a half, very much trying to support the Arab Spring, especially through its Al Jazeera television network. But of course, dissent in its own backyard is not being tolerated.
But with the time at 33 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world news headlines from James.
It's been announced that the United Nations is to pull out all non-essential international staff from Syria as the situation around the capital Damascus becomes more and more dangerous. As many as 25 out of 100 international staff could leave this week. Israel has rejected concerted criticism from across Europe over Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to expand settlement building after the United Nations de facto recognition of Palestinian statehood. Britain, France, Spain, Sweden and Denmark summoned the Israeli ambassadors in their capitals to hear appeals for Mr. Netanyahu to reverse course and deep disapproval of the plan to erect 3,000 more homes in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Two Kenyan presidential hopefuls indicted by the International Criminal Court for allegedly inciting post-election violence on Monday have signed a pact to join forces in next year's vote by running on the same ticket. Deputy Prime Minister Uhuru Kenyatta and former Cabinet Minister William Ruto announced the deal at a rally hosted by Ruto's United Republican Party in the Rift Valley town of Nakuru. The Doha climate negotiations have entered their second week. Correspondents say the extra time will determine whether the negotiations will gain positive result, as there was no substantial progress in the first week. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. James will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of today's news. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London. Now, within the Middle East, Qatar has consciously made efforts to be seen as a supporter of free speech. We need only think of the likes of the Al Jazeera news channel and also the Doha debates. Indeed, only a few weeks ago, Doha was the location of a summit to form a solid opposition to take on President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. But now, events surrounding an historic tradition could perhaps change the way Qatar is viewed by the outside world. The practice of duelling poets involves two orators exchanging improvised verses until the other one dries up. At one such encounter, the poet Muhammad ibn al-Dib al-Ajami is thought to have criticised the emir. As a result, he's been sentenced to life in prison. I spoke to Chris Davidson. He's a doctor, reader in Middle East politics at Durham University and author of After the Sheikhs, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies, just before we came on air. He explained how Muhammad ibn al-Din al-Ajami came to be locked up.
He'd written a few poems over the last year, especially in the wake of the Arab Spring, which had been really quite critical of all of the Gulf governments, including the government of Qatar, which of course is a traditional monarchy, or absolute monarchy if you prefer. He'd also, in some of his poems, made references to the ruling elites, to the sheikhs, describing them as fairly uninspiring individuals who messed around on PlayStations during the day.
Chris, just explain to us the circumstances of the arrest and the conviction of Muhammad ibn al-Dib al-Ajami.
Well, it's a fairly disturbing little story. Qatar, of course, is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It has a very small population of citizens comforted by vast gas reserves. So there hasn't really been much of a history of dissent from citizens, given that they've been so well taken care of. So it's unusual here to have a citizen, in this case a poet, imprisoned for criticising the ruler.
Chris, just explain to us this whole idea of duelling poets that this poet was involved with.
Well, the political culture in the Gulf states, these Gulf monarchies, really dates all the way back to the Bedouin tribal heritage, where poetry, especially recited in the colloquial Bedouin dialect, was used for political purposes as well, either venerating rulers, venerating various figures in history, or indeed criticizing them too. So it's not unusual, much as in the West we'd have various journalists or authors locked in battle of feuds that last for years. In the Gulf we often find it's the same case with poets.
One thing that struck me when I read this story is that Qatar has been quite self-consciously fostering a reputation for promoting democratic speech. One need only think of the fact that Al Jazeera was based there as the ideal place to foster democratic speech, plus the fact that Qatar have been bankrolling the uprisings in Libya and Syria.
Yes, this story really exposes the hypocrisy of Qatar. Qatar has had this external policy over the last year and a half, as you mentioned, very much trying to support the Arab Spring, especially through its Al Jazeera television network. Also even providing arms and financial aid to rebels in Libya and now, of course, increasingly Syria. But, of course, dissent in its own backyard is not being tolerated. It was quite notable that it took Al Jazeera News Network more than 24 hours to even report on this story, even though most of its competitor international networks had had full coverage the day before. Even more bizarrely, when Al Jazeera did get around to covering this story, they didn't quote any human rights activists, and instead their sole quote was handed over to the Syrian ambassador to the UN, who understandably is not particularly favourable of Qatar.
So as a result, what is the atmosphere like in Qatar when you have this apparent disconnect?
Well, I think it's a very smooth strategy that a number of the Gulf rulers have been employing for the past few years. Even though probably the poet will be able to appeal and have his sentence commuted or will even be freed, the strategy is already in place to effectively intimidate other citizens. If you give someone such a harsh sentence, using a member of your judiciary, in this case an expatriate judge, to hand out this sentence, the intimidation is already done. It doesn't matter if the sentence is then commuted or the man is pardoned.
To what degree do you think, as you mentioned a moment ago, that the Arab Spring has a chilling effect on people who want to publish their work?
Well, this is something that's certainly the case in the Gulf monarchies, and certainly Qatar. You have universities there, you have think tanks, you have major international conferences taking place, but it's quite clear that any strong criticism of the ruling elite will not be tolerated. That places all of these international organizations, journalists, scholars who visit and work in the country in a very awkward position, because they now know it's quite clear what the red line is or what the taboo topic is. You can't insult or criticize the ruler of that country.
How much sympathy do you think this poet will have from other countries within the area?
Actually, he's pretty famous in the region, especially in Saudi Arabia. So no love lost, of course, between Saudi and Qatar, but they are bound together in this one issue by one thing, which is the survival of traditional monarchy. So I think in some ways the palaces in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia will be quite pleased at this verdict in Qatar. It sends out this chilling effect, of course, and this intimidation of Gulf citizens. But on the other hand, I think there's quite a lot of popularity for this poet in other countries, and quite a lot of criticism of Qatar and its duplicitous policy in the Arab world. This helps to expose that and expose the hypocrisy underpinning it.
And what's the reaction been from countries outside the region, and how much pressure can they exert on the Qatari authorities?
Well, beyond the region, there's been fairly universal condemnation of this. I think almost every major news wire and news outlet has been criticising Qatar for this. I think, of course, the danger is that if the emir steps in and then releases the man through a royal pardon in the next few days, that the story will be swept under the carpet. But as I've hopefully explained, this is very much part of the strategy. It's naive to imagine that the judiciary in Qatar is separate from the palace somehow and that the emir was unaware of this looming verdict. I think really, though, it's limiting what the international community can do. Qatar is very well positioned at the moment. It's been playing a key role in various conflicts and revolutions in the region. Britain, France, America, etc. need Qatar as a proxy at the moment. So any criticism will be rather discreet and muted.
Dr. Chris Davidson there, reader in Middle East Politics at Durham University, talking to me a little earlier on today. You're with Midori House. In a moment, we'll hear how the former French First Lady believes in today's climate, there is no place for feminism.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on Monocle.com.
Now, some might argue that the subject of our next item is a lucky girl indeed. She's a happily married fan of polyandry. She's enjoyed a career as a model and a musician, but is now carving out a new niche as a stay-at-home mother. Carla Bruni Sarkozy says her generation doesn't need feminism. It's a bold statement and it's provoked outrage. By comparison to other nations, there is still some way to go, arguably, when it comes to the role of women in France. The French journalist Valeria Costa met our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. She told him just outrageous she believes Madame Bruni Sarkozy's comments have been.
Hi Valeria, apparently Carla Bruni is not a feminist anymore. Was she ever a feminist?
No, I don't think she was. She said she was left-wing at some point, but that changed too.
And it's quite interesting because before her image was kind of quite a carefree one. She was like a singer, folk, and she had a lot of lovers. It was all about freedom. What changed? Why did she become bourgeois?
I think at some point there was a lot of backlash because Nicolas Sarkozy was accused of being very bling and she had to change her image accordingly. And she said that she spent lots of time watching DVDs at home. I think that's when it happened.
I read your very interesting article on The Independent, and you mentioned that actually feminism is as relevant as ever in France. Why is that? What is happening in feminism in France?
Well, feminism is having a really big moment. There is a Ministry for Women's Rights, which hasn't happened since the 80s. Why is it relevant? Well, to start, lots of reasons. Equality, like lack of equality in pay, violence against women, rape, not being taken seriously.
And François Hollande's government is quite, I would say, more feminist than Nicolas Sarkozy, right? He even had a new minister for women's rights.
Yeah, absolutely. It might not be to the liking of the Sarkozys, really.
And can you tell us a little bit more about this new minister of women's rights? I think her name is Najat Vallaud Belkacem.
Yeah, she's also the spokesperson to the government. We haven't had a ministry of women's rights since the 80s, and it's supposed to implement, to work on women's equality.
And you, in your article, you also mentioned that actually, contrary to what Bruni said, that feminism is still needed. Why is that?
It's needed because of violence against women. It's needed because rape is still not taken seriously in France. But it's also needed because there's no equality of pay, because there's no proper representation of women in political spheres, because there's lots of sexist advertisements. It's also needed because on the cover of Vogue, where Carla Bruni did that interview, she looks 22 and she's actually 44. And that's actually quite worrying, I think.
And do you think the problem is just bad in France, or is kind of, you would say, it happens all over Europe, all around the world? Or is there something particularly bad in France when you talk about women's issues?
That's an interesting question, because we wonder that after the Strauss-Kahn scandal, was there something specific to France? Was there a special sexism in France? I don't know. I'd say that feminism is needed in France as everywhere else.
Coming back to Bruni, Carla Bruni, how damaging would be that for her career? Because there was quite a backlash. I didn't see any articles saying, actually, Carla Bruni was right, you know, she expressed her views.
Yeah, she's releasing an album just now. I think, actually, the interview was part of, you know, starting the promotion for that album. Yeah, obviously, she's not becoming more popular.
Yeah, was she ever liked in France?
No, and that's maybe one of the things that is actually not really fair. I think she's also not liked for misogynistic reasons, such as having had lots of lovers and also the fact that she was really beautiful and now looks a bit strange. So, you know, that does make me a bit uneasy. I don't think we need her to tell us that feminism is not needed.
And talking about first ladies, I want to ask your opinion on the current first lady, Valérie Trierweiler. She seems to me quite feisty and quite a feminist in a way. I know a lot of people criticize her, but I kind of like her. What do you think about her?
Yeah, she seems to be an interesting character. She made a big mess on Twitter at some point because she got really angry. I don't know, it's interesting. We need to see what happens.
Well, and she seems to kind of combine her career and being a first lady as well. Is that a first in France?
Yeah, but it's actually, she's a journalist. It's actually really difficult to be a journalist and a first lady. And I think it's impossible to be a political journalist and a first lady. And I think we would understand why. That's complicated.
And Carla Bruni is also, she, straight after this, some bits of the interview were released to the press, she kind of said sorry.
She apologized.
So maybe is she regretting what she said?
Yeah, she apologized to Elle. The apology is actually really interesting. She said many things. She said her words had been taken out of context. And she also said that it was a clumsy phrase. So I don't really know what happened. But she said that if feminism means wanting more freedom, then she is a feminist. And I love the if.
And that was Valeria Costa talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. We considered playing one of Carla Bruni's hits, but we decided against it. Here's another notable lady from France, perhaps not necessarily flying the flag for feminism, though. This is Alizé with Moi Lolita. In the great French tradition of encouraging young teenage girls to sing about being Lolita, that was Alizé et moi Lolita. You with Midori House.
It's time now to fly to the Eastern Seaboard, where our New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears awaits us with tales of Delta and Virgin, the New York Times, and Obama's plans for the post-Sandy clear-up. All over lunch, too. Welcome and bon appetit, Aisha. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell us about Delta's bid for Virgin Atlantic.
Delta have made a bid for Virgin Atlantic, which is, I think, some people are a little bit upset about because they think that Delta isn't so good. But Delta does seem to be leading, flying the flag for American carriers over the next couple of years. So they are hoping to buy out Singapore Airlines' 49% stake of Virgin Atlantic, which would give the American carrier a lot more landing slots at Heathrow, and they can move forward in their global expansion. It also means that Virgin Atlantic would become part of the Sky Team, codeshare, and then they could expand their reach into the US. And the strange thing is that Virgin Atlantic and Virgin America, who operate a domestic business here in the US, they actually have a different they're different companies, so it wouldn't compete with that.
You mentioned there that Delta don't necessarily enjoy the greatest reputation at the moment. What will this do for their reputation?
I think they're spending a huge amount of money on changing their reputation as a whole anyway. So they're investing a lot of money in a new terminal in JFK. They've got by far the biggest network of any US carrier, as American Airlines and United, the United Continental merger, which is a very, very messy merger that really kind of missed out on a good rebranding opportunity. As those kind of continue to slump and people are not happy with that, Delta seems to be moving forward. They're based in Atlanta, but New York will be their big hub soon. And so I think that if this does go ahead, it'll push them up to a better status as a global airline.
Let's move on to an area which is also suffering a bit of battering in terms of PR and branding. I'm talking about the media and the print media in particular. The New York Times is making people redundant, not necessarily by force. They're taking voluntary redundancies, but tell us a little bit more about that.
Indeed. Well, there's two big media stories that are coming out today. The shuttering of the Daily Murdoch's News Corp iPad newspaper, as well as the layoffs, which Jill Abramson has announced, the executive editor of the New York Times. They're wanting to cut 30 newsroom positions. There are currently just over 1,000 employees in the newsroom over the New York Times. And, you know, it's coming with a lot of, despite the fact that their new online subscription model has got a lot of followers. Apparently their ad sales online over the company fell 2.2% over the last year. They had a lot of cuts in 2008. The newsroom lost 100 jobs. But this time around, they're not trying to just lay off people. They're asking people to volunteer. If that doesn't happen, the company will be forced to fire a number of people. And that Mark Thompson, of course, who was known for cost cutting at the BBC, is heading this up too. So it's a sad time at the New York Times, but it's such a huge machine of a company that this seems inevitable. And obviously the Murdoch thing is another big story that's going on over here.
I must confess, when I first read about the New York Times cost cutting, I thought that you could just indeed replace New York Times with the three letters BBC. Were people expecting Thompson to do this?
I think so. And I think that, you know, with the New York Times, it's the three letters of NYT. You know, that really is, people are saying the same thing over here. They've got to change their business model. With over, you know, 1,100 people in the newsroom, that's a lot of people. They've cut their business side by 60% over the last year as well. But clearly, it's not just print media. You know, you're looking at what's happening with the Daily and what Murdoch's chosen to do. They've apparently lost more than $30 million over the last year, despite charging each reader $1 a week to be part of it. So there's a lot of rethinking going on with across editorial here in the States.
In terms of people having to pay $1 a week for the online offering, I think we've seen it with the Times in the United Kingdom, that people have been quite reluctant to go behind a paywall. Is the demise of the Daily perhaps a symptom of this?
It's you know, the Daily, is it due to problems with the app? Is it due to problems with what people think about News Corp? Is it due to problems with what content they're putting on there? Critics are saying that the app was far too general interest and fussy and wasn't really made for people who want to read newspapers. You've got a lot of people subscribing online to the New York Times, but clearly not enough. The Daily apparently needed about 500,000 subscribers to break even, but only 120,000 weekly readers were listed last year. So there's not the same. I think companies are realizing that people aren't reading online as perhaps as much as they had thrown money into.
Nor can it be seen as being as profitable as many would hope. Let's move finally to the choice of a New York native to oversee the Fed response to Hurricane Sandy's clear-up.
Indeed, Obama has appointed Sean Donovan, who is the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, to look after New York and New Jersey to kind of get the get everything going and help Congress kind of decide on how they're going to help recover from Hurricane Sandy for the area. And I think that was a good choice for Obama. A lot of people in local news are saying that was a good choice to pick someone who is from the area and knows the area. And he had personally was affected by people who died in the hurricane. So it's a good move on Obama's part.
They've already made comparisons that Donovan will do what he can to avoid any repetition of Katrina. How much is that being talked about?
I think, well, that's been talked about from the beginning of the situation. I mean, Hurricane Katrina, on all accounts, was much worse than Hurricane Sandy. So, you know, it shouldn't be compared too much, but he will be making sure that FEMA don't make the same mistakes that they did at Hurricane Katrina.
Aisha Spears in New York, thank you very much as ever. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Alad John, our researcher, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, and our studio man, Sam Impey. Next up is Culture, where Robert Bound will be finding out how to make an orchestra out of a load of old printers.
I could go dee-dee-dee-dee, and the printer here would go bop-bop-bop-bop. I mean, it was killer.
The mind boggles. And in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Tamsin Smith will be your hosts for today's episode of The Monocle Daily. Louise Beale will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.